All right, thank you. I'll ask the marshal to open court for us.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Brian, and Judge Berkey, the Honorable James Flory presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals on November 18 of 2021. This is our second of three oral arguments that we have here this morning. This is the case in the matter of the welfare of the child of LH, court file A210872. As I'm sure you're both aware, even though we are appearing via Zoom today, our rules for court remain the same, meaning that each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. We are recording these proceedings today, and we'll make the recordings available to the public during our normal course of business. And so it would be of great assistance if you could identify yourselves for our record at the beginning of each of your arguments. So with that, we'll begin. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Mr. Hamilton and Ms. Wierisma. Your Honor, my name is Teresa Paulson. I represent the appellant in this matter. The basis of this appeal is that is twofold. It really deals with the clear abuse of discretion that has occurred in the district court at this point for the misapplications of the law, which directly negatively affected Mr. Harris's rights to due process, and also was a clear abuse of discretion about the best interests of the child in this matter.
So if I can just jump in to clarify regarding the, and good morning, regarding the argument, it seemed to me that the appellant was making a due process challenge. Am I correct that we're analyzing this under due process? Yes, the statutory provisions are important for that, but it's not like there's a separate statutory analysis that we're doing. This is a due process analysis?
I should have clarified that better, Your Honor. It's twofold. The statutory violation results in a due process violation, so the clear abuse of discretion about the law has a direct impact to the client's due process. So it's twofold. So when we have this word immediately, the statute is clear. There's an immediacy that's required, which the dictionary going through the statutes of statute.
Before we get to dictionary definitions, I wasn't sure because as I looked at your written brief, I didn't see you arguing ambiguity. So are we saying the statute's ambiguous and then we are looking at statutory canons of construction, or are you arguing that unambiguously there's a requirement that the county immediately file one of the two petitions contemplated?
It's unambiguous, Your Honor. It's very clearly written. There's no room for argument as to the immediacy. It's that the harm that was caused, it harms the client in under due process. And if I didn't clarify the due process argument very well in the brief, so I will clarify it here. The way that it harms my client is that he is in a stalled place where the county is not offering reasonable efforts, is not filing a mandatory petition, and he has no right to be heard in front of a court regarding reasonable efforts arguments or have any finality or certainty about the process that will be undertaken. Instead, with the waiting of the 4 months here, it is not a harm. There's no harmless error at this point. It becomes very harmful. It becomes the county basically.
I'll try to make this short. I need you to address, you know, you're talking about the 4 months. At what point in time in this timeline should your client have brought that up? And my question is, have you not forfeited that by bringing up the question of the what you call delay only in the post-trial motions? Motion for a new trial.
So I was not the trial attorney, and the trial attorney is permanently unavailable at this point. At some point, if we're looking at what is an expedited TPR require, respectfully, due process and fundamental fairness should be something that is preserved at the post-trial record. But at the same time, the county should be well aware of that requirement, and so should the court. It's a specialized court. The judges are dedicated to juvenile law. The statute is referenced on a repetitious basis every single week with the number of expedited TPRs that are filed by the county in Ramsey County. Whether or not it's formally preserved in the pretrial proceedings, it was preserved in the post-trial record as something that was requested to be readdressed by the judge, and the judge completely ignored those arguments at that point. And in either event, the reality is the county waited for 4 months and the judge made no findings of fact or law about the delay of filing in its final order, and did not address the delay in the county's filing process, even though it received testimony that the county was aware starting in August that this father had a prior involuntary termination and that the county was relying upon a finding of palpable unfitness, and then bringing it to a trial, filing a petition 4 months after the fact. And there was no question from the judge whether or not the county actually believed this man to be a fit parent for those 4 months and permitted him to be around the child at the meetings. And and instead left the matter in limbo for a period of 4 months so that they could gather more evidence. It wasn't until there was a subsequent event that the county decided to file anything. So at that point, by that delay, other facts obviously occurred, which triggered the filing of the expedited termination of parental rights. That said, the reasonable effort statute does require a finding of fact from the county to apply for that. And here the county has the control about when are they going to file a petition. So when the county has that level of control about when do they file a petition, they're in control of the timelines that are being imposed on another person because they're an adversary. They were an adversary for that entire 4 months prior to the filing of the petition. And at that point, they are collecting evidence that they later used against him in that trial setting as well as justification. But more importantly, I would direct the court's attention as we transition into the best interest and the violation of and the clear abuse of discretion regarding the best interest of the child. The clear abuse of discretion here is that when the guardian ad litem testifies that it is fine for father, and this was put into the order, it's fine for father to have contact with the child following a termination of parental rights. That's in the best interest of the child. It's in the best interest of the child for the father to voluntarily provide financial support that after a termination of parental rights. The guardian ad litem is testifying essentially that it's in the best interest of the child for there to be contact and for there to be financial support, but then arguing the guardian ad litem still creates the conclusion that there should be a termination of parental rights to make it so that the mother cannot file and exert any responsibilities upon the father.
So how would the outcome of the proceedings differed if the petition had been filed in August instead of the 4 month delay?
At August, it would have been different for a couple of reasons. In August, the county and the guardian ad litem still had a belief that it was fine for the father to be present in the child's life. He would have been entitled to legal counsel from the court-appointed attorney's office if he qualified at that point. But he would have been able to argue the reasonable efforts, ask for a case plan, ask for what the county is looking for maintaining those rights.
He would have been. Maybe I misunderstood. I thought he was represented by an attorney at all stages of the proceeding.
No, and in the way that the statute works for court-appointed counsel, Your Honor, is that a person is not appointed court-appointed counsel until a petition is filed. So they have a right to pay.
So what you're trying to say then is that, at least this is what I'm hearing, is that he should have had an attorney the minute there was a petition by the county to the county attorney to file a TPR way back when, 4 months back in August.
If the county had filed a petition back in August, he would have been able to apply for the services of the court-appointed attorney at that moment, receive legal counsel about what steps he needed to take to protect his parental rights. And even if reasonable efforts were waived, it is not unusual for private for court-appointed counsel to create a plan with a client about what steps do they need to take to defend themselves and what services do they need to be active in order to create a record for maintaining their parental rights. So that, but how the statute works is that the legislature has not authorized access, unlike the public defender's office in a criminal matter, the statute and the courts have not authorized court-appointed counsel to be available at pre-petition proceedings where interviews are being conducted, where investigation is happening prior to the filing of a petition. So all of those interviews, they can occur. And if a person wants an attorney, they have to pay for an attorney. If they're indigent and can't afford an attorney, they do not have an opportunity to have court-appointed counsel there. And but at that moment, he was working. So he was earning $14 to $14.75 an hour. I've not done the calculation. I do not know if he would have qualified for the services of a public defender or of a court-appointed attorney at that time.
Isn't that pretty important to your argument that the delay was a prejudice because of the impact it has on his ability to have an attorney? I mean, if he's making enough money that he would be able to hire an attorney privately, then there's no change. There's nothing that's different, right?
Well, at that point, what usually happens with the...
No, but my question is what you just said about you haven't done the calculations. Isn't that really important? Because if you did the calculations and it turns out he has too much money to have qualified in August, then there would be no difference if the petition had been filed in August or not, because at that time he wouldn't have qualified anyway. So in the pre-petition interviews that you're talking about, if he didn't qualify at that time anyway, then there would be no difference, right?
Well, there still would be a difference, Your Honor, because at the petition stage, when it comes into court, they're brought into a process where they're given the phone number and information about how to speak with court-appointed counsel. They are given an opportunity to know where to reach out to for starting that.
All right, but let's just assume. And in August, he doesn't qualify. His income is too high. Let's assume that's the case. What's the prejudice in terms of his right to an attorney at that point?
So assuming he doesn't qualify, he would still be inside of the process and he would have been differently situated because there would have been no domestic assault charge at that point. And since it was an expedited TPR, it would have been in a 60-day period with different facts.
Because but then you're saying the real prejudice stems from the incarceration and the new charge, not from the delay, right? Well, during the delay, he happened to pick up a new charge. But what I'm trying to get you to answer is, how is his right to an attorney changed if he didn't qualify in August, assuming he doesn't qualify?
Well, Mom would have qualified in August because Mom still qualified the entire time. Mom also is represented by a court-appointed counsel. So, and they were working together as a unit at that time. So there would have been some access to him. He would have also been aware that the county truly intended to file a petition so that he would have known to at least start calling around to see if there was an attorney available somewhere and to look for that. Without any of the action from the county at that point, he was completely unaware that the county was actually going to take any action on this because there was no notification from the trial testimony alone. There was no notification to him and no notice that the county was intending ever to file an expedited TPR against him. So
maybe I could switch gears too, because you're running, you've got 2 minutes left. So I'm also curious, assuming that we agree that the statute unambiguously places a requirement on the county to do anything in a certain amount of time, let's assume that your read of the statute's correct. How does a new trial remedy the harm here?
Because that's where the best interest of the child kicks in, Your Honor. Financial support is...
No, but that's I think that's a separate issue, right? Unless you're saying that you would argue something differently in this trial than you did the first time around I don't see how a new trial makes any difference. The harm is the delay in 4 months, right? If you have a new trial, you can't go back in time and undo those things and have a different 4 month situation where he has additional visitation and is able to progress through some parenting plan, et cetera. That doesn't happen, right? If you're asking for a new trial, you just go back and present new testimony. So how does the remedy requested here, a new trial, address the harm?
Well, Your Honor, at this point, my client is no longer in custody. He's no longer in jail. He's working his parole. And at this point, he's differently situated. The reality is the judge.
All right, but that's different. A new trial is different than a new process allowing you to present new evidence and to give him a new opportunity to do things that he couldn't have done in that 4 month period of time. So the remedy, it sounds like you're now saying at oral argument, is not a new trial, but to start this whole process or essentially dismiss a petition and start it all over, giving him an opportunity to do things that he couldn't have done before. A new trial is simply you just go back in front of a judge next week and present evidence.
And Your Honor, very briefly, the reality of this case is that there is, I'm out of time. Do you want me to finish my point?
If you can finish your point fairly briefly, you can go ahead and answer the question, Ms. Paulson. Otherwise, you can address it in your rebuttal.
Okay. The reality is that even if the judge in her order did not had an abuse of discretion as well regarding the best interest of the child and the support that was due to the child. It is not unusual. It happens very regularly in family court that a parent is suspended on their parenting time, but is still required to financially support the child, which goes into the In re Alie area of my brief that I was hoping to have more time to argue. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Paulson. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Robert Hamilton, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney on behalf of respondent Ramsey County Social Services Department. We're asking this court to affirm the trial court's termination of parental rights in all respects. Appellant raises two arguments for asking for a new trial, both of which should be denied. This first argument is premised on an alleged violation of Minnesota statute section 260C.503 subdivision 2 based on when the county filed the TPR petition underlying this matter. It's the county's position that appellant's argument is premised on a misinterpretation of this statute. So subdivision 2, it sets out a two-step process for filing expedited.
Mr. Hamilton, again, good morning to you. Before you get to the merits of the statutory interpretation argument, I'm curious what your position is regarding the timing of this motion. There is case law that says it's too late to bring a motion in the context of a motion for new trial. It's too late to bring arguments like statutory interpretation. So there's a potential threshold question there. What's the state's position regarding whether this was properly raised and preserved?
Your Honor, I would largely rest on my brief with that. The county's position is that this matter was not preserved for appeal, and this matter should be deemed forfeited pursuant to the forfeiture doctrine and invited error doctrine. This was an obvious and knowable issue from the date that the TPR petition was filed. Appellant was represented by counsel at every stage of these proceedings, including a trial. Appellant never raised this issue until his post-trial motion, until receiving an unfavorable verdict. He's now using this motion to try to essentially get a second bite of the apple with this trial. So it is the county's position that this issue was not preserved for appeal and that the court should deny it and dismiss it simply based on the threshold issue of it being forfeited. Regarding subdivision 2, subdivision 2 is a two-step process for filing expedited TPR petitions. The first step relates solely to social services agencies and the second step applies to county attorneys. The first step requires social services agencies to investigate a report, and if they discover that a certain criteria is met, including if a parent has a prior involuntary TPR, they are required to ask the county attorney to immediately file a petition. The second step provides that the county attorney must file the TPR petition unless it, in conjunction with the social services agency, determines that an alternative petition is in the child's best interest. Importantly, there is no language in that section requiring the county attorney to immediately file a termination of parental rights petition when asked to do so. In fact, the statute pretty clearly implies the opposite by explicitly allowing the county attorney and social services agency to determine if an alternative petition would be more appropriate, and that's often a time-consuming process in these cases. Additionally, allowing the county attorney this latitude to determine when to file a TPR petition comports with the county attorney's inherent prosecutorial discretion in its filing decisions, as well as its added role in child protection decisions in considering and advancing the public interest. And then getting to the issue of prejudice, the appellant was not prejudiced by this petition's filing date. The appellant's argument is largely premised on him being deprived of reasonable efforts and the right to court-appointed counsel, but both of those entitlements are not implicated until a case is brought under court jurisdiction. Once this case was brought under court jurisdiction, it proceeded according to the statutory guidelines for termination of parental rights matters, meaning the trial began within 60 days of the admit-deny hearing. Appellant does not articulate and doesn't explain how he was prejudiced by having counsel appointed for a 60-day timeline beginning in February 2021 as opposed to September 2020. And if anything, having that added delay would constitute a benefit of additional time to work on engage in services and amass evidence to show parental fitness. To the extent that appellant is arguing that having an attorney could have helped give him some guidance on how to proceed in this case, there's no evidence in the record to support that argument. And there's plenty of evidence contrary to it. Appellant did have an attorney for 2 months in this case and did not engage in any services, even after he was appointed counsel. Appellant had access to court-appointed counsel for 14 months in his prior child protection matter and did not engage in any services in that matter either. At trial in this matter, there's no testimony from him that he didn't understand what he needed to do, that he was lost in this process. This was someone who simply just chose not to engage in this process, both in this case and in his prior child protection case. And then finally, as the court alluded to during appellant's argument, the remedy that the appellant seeks in this of a new trial, it doesn't address his alleged, the deficiency that he alleges. Appellant's arguing that the petition in this case is fatally defective, but the remedy that's being sought is a new trial on that same petition. So there is, in lack of that remedy, this court should also deny.
Mr. Hamilton, yes. Do you agree with the concept that on remand, there would be a new opportunity to engage in reasonable efforts or, you know, some opening of not the record, but of essentially allowing a parent to have a second opportunity to establish what would be necessary to avoid a termination at a second trial? Or is the universe of facts closed on remand and simply a new trial would be regarding what was in place at the time of the first trial? What facts had occurred by the time of the first trial?
Well, Your Honor, it would not be the status as of the first trial. It would be his current parental fitness. That would be what we need to be looked into at that point. But from the county's position is that there is no basis for remand because there was no prejudice and there's also no evidence in the record to support that appellant was prejudiced or that he would benefit from this additional time. So, yes, that we oppose the remand and that the and the county's position is that there is no basis for remand because appellant, well, there was no violation of the statute and appellant was not prejudiced by it, by any alleged violation in this delay in filing. And then just to briefly touch on the best interest argument, appellant's argument is premised primarily on the loss of future court-ordered child support. The trial court properly considered this issue in its TPR order and weighted against the child's interest in safety and stability and being free of an abusive parent. And this balancing and determination that termination of appellant's parental rights is in the child's best interests, it was not an abuse of discretion. The appellant's domestic violence history cannot be understated. It stretches over a decade. It involves at least 8 domestic related convictions, 6 of which are felonies. His domestic violence has been directed at his partners, at the mothers of his children, and at his children themselves, including hitting them with shoes and belts, and also included assaulting AH's mother, in this case, when she was 5 months pregnant with AH and putting her in the hospital. And then just briefly to touch on something that Ms. Paulson mentioned in her oral argument, that at the outset of this case, the county had decided that appellant was, it would not pursue termination of parental rights, and it was fine with appellant having contact with his child. That is not true. There was an active domestic abuse no contact order prohibiting appellant from having contact with AH's mother. There was a letter sent, it's in the record as Exhibit 3 on October 30th, 2020, where the county says to a letter to the appellant from the county stating its intent to seek a termination of his parental rights. This wasn't a matter of the county simply waiting to collect evidence. And in fact, in child protection cases, it's quite often the opposite. That if anyone, the county is prejudiced by, I shouldn't say prejudiced, but it's the county who ultimately is hurt by a delay in proceedings because it allows the parent to engage in services that it wouldn't otherwise have been able to if the county had immediately filed the petition. So I just wanted to note that at no point in this case did the county believe that appellant was an appropriate care provider for the child. And then also with respect to the child support argument specifically, there's no evidence in the record that appellant has ever financially contributed to the child, meaning that his willingness to provide any future support with or without a court order is entirely speculative. I know Ms. Paulson mentioned the testimony that the guardian ad litem said that the child's mother can decide if appellant can have contact with the child, and that somehow cuts against it, that it being in his best interest to terminate his parental rights. Having parental rights gives the appellant the ability to come into court to seek custody, seek parenting time with this child. And regardless of how likely or unlikely that is, just that basis has been upheld by courts as sufficient to terminate parental rights. I would direct the court to the ASR decision, which I cite in my brief, which similarly provides that when a parent is poses an imminent threat to his child, regardless of the unlikeliness of him seeking custody, his ability to do that by itself could be sufficient to terminate parental rights. And then finally, there's nothing preventing appellant from providing the child with financial support, regardless of his parental rights status. To the extent that this argument exists, is an argument that should be raised by the mother or by the child through the mother. This is not an argument that appellant father should be making. If the appellant is truly concerned with the child's financial needs, that's something that he can help with. to the extent that any court orders, any domestic abuse, no contact orders might prevent that, those orders could be modified to allow it. To the extent that appellant is saying that he'll only provide support for his child if the court directs him to do so, that would seem to indicate a lack of sincere interest in supporting the child. Ultimately, the trial court correctly weighed the appellant and the child's interest in preserving the parent-child relationship and did not err in concluding that termination was in the child's best interests. The appellant poses a significant risk to the child's physical and emotional health, and this risk far outweighs the child's interest in any speculative court-ordered child support in the future. So based on that, the court did not abuse its discretion in determining that termination of appellant's rights was in the child's best interests. And we would ask the court to affirm the district court on those grounds as well. And I have nothing additional. I'm happy to answer any questions that the court might have.
Seeing none from the panel, thank you for your argument, Mr. Hamilton. Ms. Paulson, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, starting from the guardian ad litem statements, it's the financial support aspect. Also, he could not even if he voluntarily gave it, it's about whether or not the mother could demand it. So a voluntary giving is different than the right to seek. It's a different responsibility. And in this case is different than other cases because the mother actually in testimony opposed termination of the father's parental rights because she wanted to have that financial support.
Did she not also want to co-parent with him?
Your Honor, honestly, I cannot recall. I think she wanted to preserve the relationship between the paternal grandparents, the legal relationship between the paternal grandparents and the child. And that was the overarching concern, was that this child would have a connection, a legal connection, with the rights of, with the legal rights of that legal contact with paternal grandparents and extended family as well, so that he wouldn't lose an entire side of his own identity through a termination process. The statutory, there are many places in the statutes that also require the executive branch to immediately file. I would direct the court's attention to the mandatory prosecution provisions under the domestic assault statutes. It's not unusual in cases dealing with family matters, for the legislature to legislate how is the county supposed to proceed. And here, even if we consider Exhibit 3 as a maltreatment finding that the county is giving him notice that they will terminate his parental rights, they then wait an additional 4 months, which sends a dual message to the same person. They're expecting the county to do something, but nothing happens. And they, even with the presence of a domestic abuse no contact order, the county still...
How much time do you think is too much? You know, you're complaining about 4 months. Would 2 months be too much time too?
I think 30 days minimum. I think 30 days should be the maximum. If you're going to make a legal threat about what you intend to legally do, there should be some follow through with it.
So, go ahead.
I'm just going to say, if that's the case, then wouldn't that be for the legislature to put that time frame in the statute and not for us to speculate about it?
Well, that's the beauty of the word immediately, Your Honor, because that's when the legislature, because it says shall file. So when we take that as a whole, it's unambiguous. The legislature intended for the agency as a party to seek action immediately and to take efforts immediately. There has been no explanation from the county at trial or even in post-trial as to why the county delayed it for 4 months. And that should give pause to the court that they say that the best explanation is it just takes time. Well, during that time, they issue a maltreatment letter, they have a DANCO in place, and they do nothing. They do not offer services, they do not offer parenting time, they do not send it in for a referral for child support to be a child support action to be collected. It is absolutely nothing that is done. There is no compelling child protection case that is filed either. So it's the argument that it takes time to collect evidence would be meritorious if the county was actually providing reasonable efforts and actually providing services and a case plan to assist the father with determining whether or not he can actually remedy their concerns about him being a parent around this child. So here the county is arguing that this man, my client, poses a severe risk to this child and then go through his domestic assault convictions. And yet the argument they want is special pleading on they need more time to gather even further evidence. They had this evidence starting day one, and they still waited 4 months. And the only thing that happened was a new case was caught and he was put into custody. And the argument that he didn't work any services is disingenuous because we were in the middle of a pandemic and he was in custody at a place that did not offer services. So they do not argue, nowhere in the trial transcript does the county create a record of what services were available to him for him to voluntarily work. And nowhere in the record does it show, do they actually justify a delay other than an ambiguous statement on, you just needed to give us more time.
I see your time is up. Thank you, Ms. Paulson. And we thank counsel for your arguments and briefing in the matter. We